Welcome, everybody, to The Rad Life, the only talk radio show that takes you along with host and age explorer Rod Gontos on his continuing journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older. The Rad Life is brought to you this week by Your Home for a Lifetime, a company dedicated to empowering you to stay safely, independently, and comfortably in your own home. And now here is your host, Rad Gontos.
Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon, sir.
How are you?
Okay. Just watching with amazement the massive destruction in Houston. It's hard to believe.
It's unbelievable. I was watching it this morning, and it's not over. I mean, there's a town just outside of Houston that supposedly got more rain than Houston. They got something in the range of about 30 inches in a period of like less than 24 hours.
Yeah. The only thing you can say about this is every time they have one of these 500-year storms, which seem to happen every 5 years now, once you do, they learn so much. How big is big? How bad is bad? And they seem to get better. This response seems to be much better than the one at Katrina, where they were just totally clueless how
to
handle
this. And it's interesting. We'll tie it into the show today. But you know, what's fascinating to me is the area. I mean, I was there, you know, not there on location, but I remember Katrina. I remember the disastrous situation, difference of realities because of the lower wards and the whole topography and what have you, and certain parts of the community that were maybe more impacted than others.
They told everybody to go to the convention center, and they didn't know what to do with
right.
them all.
Right. Well,
didn't have water, didn't have food, didn't have anything.
Right. And then you had, you know, the old Rocket Stadium yesterday or the day before that was closed off, and then basically there was so much shaming going on that they actually opened it. But that, you know, our thoughts and prayers go out to everybody that is dealing with that, because it's just unbelievable. I mean, I'm staring at the TV, I'm going, this can't be real, and it's still raining.
Yeah,
it's
still raining. Well,
now the dams are like overflowing.
Already, it's the largest amount of rainfall in one city, in one location ever. It's also the only storm I can think of where it hit land and then backed up and went out and gathered some other steam and came back and hit it again. It
right.
not only hit land, it was moving so slowly that it just kept drenching and drenching and drenching, just kept pulling the water and off of the Gulf and dropping it there. So it's the largest natural disaster in terms of economic impact ever, bigger than Katrina. It's the largest rainfall we've ever seen in the continental United States
right.
ever. And it certainly probably, I don't know this for a fact, but it probably flooded more area than we've ever seen flooded before.
There was a gentleman that used to be ahead of that region for FEMA that was actually being interviewed this morning, and he said that. He said that it's actually the largest disaster. So, you know, all that being said, we could use some more rain over here.
Yeah, right. Bring some over here. Well, and the only other thing I'll say about this, because I know we get into politics a lot, and I would just say this. I wished the president would have said this, or I hope somebody will say this. It shows what can happen when we all drop our petty partisan politics and work together. You've got a black Democratic mayor working with a very conservative white governor, and they're not bashing each other. They're not picking on it. They're not second-guessing each other, at least not now. They're working hand-in-hand. The federal government seems to be working hand-in-hand. Neighbors are pitching in. Everybody's doing what they have to do. And there's been an incredibly small number of people that have died. There's been a large disaster. So I thought the president would use this as a chance to reboot his whole administration and say, look, you know, instead of dividing
let's put things aside
and work together.
But let's do this, right? Let's not pass judgment on anything right now.
No, I
because
agree.
Because anybody, you know, that is dealing with the largest disaster we've had in as long as I can remember. Okay, let's just see how it works out. I agree with you. I think it's very noble and very very nice to see everybody come together and everybody just throw in and try to help the people that are unbelievably impacted.
For example, I was watching Fox, you know, which always tries to pick apart, as MSNBC picks apart the conservatives.
You know what's funny is you don't want to go into politics, but then we just keep going down.
Well, I was just going to say this. I'll make one other point here. And the Fox anchor started second-guessing, well, do you think that the Democratic mayor did the right decision not evacuating? And everybody in the panel, everybody, left and right, said, knock it off. This guy had 2 days to decide.
Right.
You can't get 5 million people out doing the best they can. Nobody seems to want to criticize anybody right now, and that's refreshing.
So what you're saying, and again, he challenges me every single time, Logan, Logan Mahtashami is my guest today, and Paul challenges me every single time. He goes off on these tangents, and he says, okay, so how are you going to bring it back to the show? How are you going to bring it back?
There's no way to bring that back.
No, there's no way to bring that back?
No way.
I got away from it. Okay, here's how you bring it back. What you're talking about is that basically we sit here and we fall into these traps, like the anchor you're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay, it's like this is dial setting about, well, I got to find something that I'm going to have a problem with. I'm going to have find something that talks back to my ideological position of what I believe.
People
right?
are upset that right. Melania well, Trump here, had well, high heels on for a while or something.
Right,
I don't know, who
right,
cares?
Right, right. Here's what I'm going to bring it back. The same thing happens with what we're going to talk about today in terms of economic projections and forecasting. Right? Certain people are of certain camp, certain people are of another camp, and they're all looking for data that basically try to support the thing, and it's the old... You know,
data to support what they've already decided.
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
Right.
So Logan doesn't know this, but prior to going into what I do for bread and butter, which is interior design, I actually have a degree in economics. And I burnt out at the age of 20 doing a master's in marketing at the Drucker Center, right? So for me, this is like I'm just going to geek out today, right?
You're going to data surf.
Oh, my God. You know, like I just like start drooling if I see, like, you know, macroeconomic statistics and reverse, you know, rates of return. I'm like, oh, my God, this is so cool, right?
Oh, my God.
But here's the thing, right? Because I remember when I went to business school, everybody looked at me and said, oh, what did you do? Oh, you had an economics degree? Oh, that's a scientific of non-knowledge. I remember one teacher telling me it's scientification of non-knowledge, right? Because I think people are stuck in their own way of and view of the world. If you really look at the statistics, it may tell you something completely different from your ideology. The courage is to actually listen to what it's being said. And this gentleman here sitting in front of me is pretty savvy with the information that he puts out. So I'm going to introduce my guest, Logan Mahtashami, who basically is I love the name, by the way, right? What is the name of the blog, Logan?
Well, it's loganmahtashami.com, but really a lot of my work is presented on my Facebook page,
right,
where I do charts daily, updated daily, Facebook lives, and we try to just talk about macroeconomics.
But hold on, okay, because I love the title. Okay, when I go to your website,
oh,
right,
yes,
what it comes up after your name?
It's Financial Truth.
Financial Truth.
Yeah. There's no truth
so
in today's world.
So today you're going to get Financial Truth.
Yeah. Oh,
okay.
Yes. So the problem with politics is, oddly enough, the California Association of Realtors asked me to speak at their brokers conference this year with economist John Hunze, and they really wanted to take a look at what would the economy look like under President Donald Trump. And I basically said, for now, it'll look the same.
Right.
You know, everyone could relax on these big negative or bullish macroeconomic theories. But politics, to me, is what the name spells out.
Go ahead.
Politics. Many blood-sucking paradise. So
have come up with the best definition
ever. Did I not tell you you're in for a good show today?
Oh, my God. So politics. Many blood-sucking little ticks here.
It has ruined to me what economic, macroeconomic studies should be. And there's a lot of bad misinformation, and it's tilted to economic ideology from a political sense. And this happened during President Obama, and it's going to happen under President Trump, and it's probably going to be here for a while. So there is a place for the middle to just look at data, to just look at numbers, to look at what they really mean. But in this day and age of headline sensationalism, yellow journalism, promoting doom and gloom or super outrageous bullish theories, if somebody could stay in the middle, because if you really want to look for the truth, you have to lose all opinions before you come into the room.
Yeah, right. You can't be biased.
And with numbers don't care what your color is, what your background is,
right,
who you are.
Right.
They are simply
But numbers are themselves fungible. Use an old legal term. You know, depending on what your assumptions are and what data you use, you can make the numbers do different things.
No, but I think what Logan is saying is the numbers, not the assessment of the numbers.
The numbers stay the same. It's
right.
The person telling you the story,
right,
what they mean.
For example, in California, we have frequent mudslides. We're talking about housing today. And there's a geologist who will come out and say, your yard is not going to slide. We fixed it. And then you get a permit and you build, and the next time it slides. And one geologist comes out and says, no, I looked at the data, and that's definitely a slide zone. It's definitely not stable. It won't. And you just keep shopping geologists till you find one that gives you the assumption. Same thing happened in the financial meltdown, where they convinced themselves all mathematical models that these derivatives were sound. They weren't.
No, they weren't. And it was easy to pick off if people had an understanding of what debt structure is.
Weren't ignoring. Somebody gave a mathematical support saying those were stable to the banks and the lenders and all the other people.
But the motivation of the people that are evaluating, be it ideologically based or profit-based.
I would tell you the biggest story about the previous cycle is when the SEC allowed the capital leverage ratios to go from 10 to 1 to 41. That basically allowed Wall Street to leverage up speculation debt to the point that they would simply turn over.
Clearly.
I actually called that an EWOM, an economic weapon of mass destruction.
You've got some great names.
Created by homegrown domestic terrorists.
Hilarious.
And they did.
The damage that they did was hilarious. It was unbelievable.
So
let's just take a minute. What's the motivation? Is it just self-interest? Is it special interest? What motivates people to do that? Because
you mean to tweak the numbers?
Yeah.
Well, financial.
Is there even an answer?
I mean, I think a lot of it comes down to financial.
The answer is money. What's the question?
Yes. Who benefits? Who profits?
Money. What's the question?
This is why regulation is needed always to curb speculation. Everything bad things happen when speculation occurs.
So we happen to be in a part of the country where there is I don't disagree necessarily in the principle of the matter, is that, you know, less government, less regulation, that regulation basically stifles business. So let's take a minute here. What are your feelings about that? I mean, you just made a point that regulation is important. Okay? Obviously, there can be over-regulation, right?
And there can be under-regulation.
But do you ever see a situation where no regulation would ever be needed?
No, because that would go against human nature. If you allow no regulations, you will definitely at some point occur speculation, because the profit motivation will occur. People will generate some type of either not even just a derivative, just some type of economic movement that will create speculation, and then it'll just garner more people into that movement.
Or they find a way to rig the system. It doesn't have to be illegal, but they buy influence, they campaign for certain breaks and whatnot, and suddenly the system isn't healthy. It doesn't operate like it's supposed to.
I had a friend of mine who worked in one of the financial powerhouses in the 80s. And it's still around, so I'm not gonna say what the name is. But basically, he told me that during their training, and it was a stock brokerage firm, during their training, their training motivation was you can always connect with somebody based on fear or greed.
Yeah,
that's the TV commercials you see, the stockbroker commercials. You know,
but basically, fear or greed.
Yeah, if you don't save enough money to retire, you're going to, you know. So that's what marketing is. Marketing is to elicit some type of response that you're missing.
Generally an emotional response.
So going back to the regulation question, where do you think we are today? What do you say to the people that think we are over-regulated? And let's just stick with California. Are we over-regulated? Is there a...
In what area?
The sector that Logan specializes in.
Which is what, housing?
Housing or you know, just financial.
If there is an over-regulation in California, it really is the ability to not allow construction from happening. We as a state, for the amount of people we have too many rules to prevent homes from being built.
Okay.
And that to me also comes in from a local political level as well.
Somebody told us, we've done housing shows before, and I don't remember the number, but maybe you do, something like, I don't know, $100,000 goes towards permits and all the other stuff you have to pay for.
But is that the regulation you're talking about?
I mean, that's part of the regulations, but it's political also. Local communities do not want more housing to be built.
No.
The environmentalists have certain rules. But in general sense, if you have a really overregulated economy, it wouldn't generate economic growth on the smaller side. The big corporations are already built out. So I think we're fine as a country, even in California. But housing is unique here just because it takes forever to build anything. And then when it gets down to the local politicians, they tend to deny it from ever happening. So this is why I think the city of Austin for a few years was building more homes than the entire state of California.
Wow.
And that's,
one of the things I read about Houston is because it had less regulated growth, it has grown out exponentially, and some of the infrastructure, sewers and stuff, are old and whatnot. It was, some theorize that maybe it was overbuilt out and therefore didn't have the infrastructure to handle that kind of.
Where do you strike the balance in your own mind? I'm not talking about in terms of political, but like let's talk about California. You're saying that there is. The housing industry is regulated to the point where we're not building enough, if I'm hearing from you.
Correct.
Okay, so where do you draw the line? Where in your own mind, where does that, is it just open-ended?
I think that unless you have a coordination between the federal government and state government to provide certain goals to be projected and met, the regulations will prevent home building from ever happening to the needs of the people. And that's you know, maybe that's not a purely regulation thing, but that's more of a political thing.
Do you think there's a part of that that's also demand and supply and price point?
It's costly to build here. This is why I think that if you ever really wanted to get affordable housing in America in general, you need the federal and the states to work together, because states have budgets and states have to follow their budgets, and there's, you know, the federal government could simply borrow as much as it wants. So there has to be some kind of cooperation. I'm not sure if that's more of a regulation thing, that's more of a cost thing.
Right.
But if the states have to follow their mandate and follow their budgets, it's very difficult to get affordable housing built, because you're going to have to raise taxes, and some
right.
people fight against that. So.
Well, and you brought up the topic of affordable housing. Okay, to some people, it's an anathema. I mean, it's just basically, you might as well just say squatters, right? You might as well say ghettos, right? I mean, in certain neighborhoods, if you raise the specter of affordable housing, you'd be basically tar and feathered, ridden out of town on a rail, because you're basically saying bring in people that basically don't have the ability to afford to live there.
Right.
And I have said it for years, like where I am down in San Clemente, that the sad reality of that is that when you don't provide for that, the people that were born and raised in that community, as they are starting their lives, cannot afford to live in that community and give it back to that community, so they end up actually losing them both in both brain drain and as a financial basis, and they move out elsewhere where the property is cheaper. Mm-hmm. So is that what you mean by affordable housing? Or what, how, define affordable housing.
The problem with affordable housing in America started in 1975. In 1975, the median square foot was 1,500 being built in America. It's right now, single family is about 2,700.
Wow.
We have built bigger and bigger homes for many decades while family sizes have gotten smaller.
Mm-hmm.
It's a profit margin for the home builders. They want to make money.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no way to actually, you can't force the builders to build cheaper homes, and they're not going to do it because it's too expensive. So this is where something where the federal government, the private sector, and state would probably need to work together. And it has to be financially beneficial for everyone, or
right.
else one group is not going to.
And what did California just pass? Didn't they pass some bill?
They passed the bill for, I think, a $4 billion bond to have a affordable housing, but I think their own metrics showed that you needed at least $15 billion to $30 billion.
And what annually. Would that money go towards?
So was it just a feel-good measure, basically?
I mean, it's something to get it started, but I just don't see, not only just in California, but the entire country, push for affordable housing unless you have a private and public, state, federal, and private sector working together, because somebody has to make money,
right.
okay, for this to work. And the builders won't do it. They haven't done it for more than four decades. And the states, the local politicians won't allow it. So you have to get almost like a federal mandate to work with the states and the builders to get something going. Because this has been a four-decade trend, and we always talk about housing in terms of home ownership, but when home prices rise like they are, the renters get to feel it.
Right.
And housing economics, home ownership is really tilted toward the college-educated income level, and you have a lot of people who don't have the ability to go to college. And if you look at the median incomes between high school dropouts and high school graduates versus college educated, you know, there's your inequality gap. It really shows in housing. And the rent inflation for them is just harder and harder. And this is where you get, you know, some of the maybe the extreme left wing or right wing movements in terms of, you know, your shelter cost is your primary cost for your budget.
Sure.
And it's just harder and harder for that group, because the college-educated Americans could be fine, you know, the because of their growth in jobs and their incomes. The middle class didn't actually shrink; it actually shrunk because there's more educated incomes out there. But for everyone else, they're paying for the rent inflation that the higher income Americans are able to afford.
You just said something shocking. You said the middle class didn't shrink. That's what everybody assumes, that the rich got richer and the poor got poorer. You're saying that some of them, they didn't get poorer, they got richer.
No, the percentages of the middle class shrunk more because we have more college-educated Americans making more money. It's actually the group of $100,000 income and more grew more than the shrinkage of those making.
So again, the definition of what you define as middle class changed.
Yes, because we have had a boom in education in this country starting from 1980, which was the growth of the prime age labor force. The baby boomers came in, they got educated and made money, but also women started to work, women started to get educated. The dual house incomes in America is over 100,000 married couple right now. So you have that, and they'll be fine. I would say I'm not worried about college educated. I think there's the whole student loan debt is completely blown out of proportion. But
yeah, they just announced, what is it, how many trillion dollars? And
it's a record number? Why do you think it's blown out of proportion?
Here's the thing. For 9 years, we've talked about a student loan debt crisis.
Yeah.
Okay? Except nobody actually decided to look at the internal numbers of student loan debt. So we have this $1 trillion number. It's a lot.
Yeah. Right.
We have $90 trillion.
A record amount. Nobody's
ever
seen this.
Right, but let's put it in perspective.
70% of student loan debt is $14,000 and under. 13% of it is about $50,000 and under. Less than 3% is over $100,000. 40% of student loan debt are grad students. They're going to make money. Now, the troubled group in student loan debt are 30% of all student loan debt are held by college dropouts. So they have the debt, but they have no income. So that group, the average balance is $9,000.
They borrowed the money but didn't get the benefit.
There's your troubled group. But if you actually look at the Great Recession, college-educated Americans, the peak unemployment rate in the Great Recession was 5%.
So would you say then, it's a very interesting point. I mean, I totally can see how that a case can be made for that. So do you think then the crisis is not in the student debt? The crisis is in encouraging people that are not either supposed to go to college or that is not their path towards a better life to pursue that as a vehicle and then not stick it through,
not get the benefit,
and now basically be settled by that debt.
Money but no benefit.
I mean, you know, it's college for everybody.
College isn't for everyone. I mean, I would.
But that's what we're selling people, right?
Well, we're selling it, except it still costs money to get there. But you actually have to be able to get into a college too. You can't be a C-minus student and be able to get into.
No, it's actually even tougher and tougher these days.
So,
I mean, you need to hire somebody to help you get into it.
I would totally support a free college mandate, putting it on the federal, you know, budget. It'd be $60 billion. It's
you
not
radical
that big.
social Bernie loving guy here.
But there's a lot of people who going to college isn't going to help them.
So why would you support a mandate like that?
Because I think there's the educated class have so much more of an advantage, and if you can get certain people into an education format rather than them not even working, to give them some type of direction, and it's not going to cost them anything. Now, obviously, the thing is, so much of it's the top tier schools that cost a lot.
Sure.
So this is why, you know, reducing student
like
loan debt to zero.
No, but he's named dropping. Okay. Yes, but however, we've had an expansion and growth in community colleges.
Yes,
and
tremendous.
And
here's the numbers
colleges.
That people don't ever.
You're giving me lots of numbers I haven't heard before.
Two third of the labor force has some type of college degree.
Okay.
Right now in 2016.
That's huge.
Yes. 8% of the labor force are high school dropouts. It's because we have grown our college-educated force by almost 12-fold since 1980.
So, Logan, what is the level of education, on average, for people that are actually currently still out of jobs, out of work?
And this,
the unemployed.
Is there a correlation or not?
Oh, yes, and it goes down. A lot of my economic work over the last 6 years was to show that the people that are struggling the most are A, high school dropouts, B, those who are coming from jail, criminally active that are not in jail, and drug addicts. This getting people to understand that we had a drug addiction problem was the hardest thing to convince people because it came in rural Republican areas.
The so-called opioid problem.
Where
we're
supposed to be saying no.
Where, you know, so it was very difficult. I mean, I am so happy that in the sense that it's finally getting the national recognition, but rural areas are struggling because you have a lot of older, uneducated males who there's so many white Republicans that are working, but there's a group that isn't, and they tend to be high school dropouts and they tend to be drug addicts. And I am all in support of a federal government guaranteed program, because there are people, most people are working. We have over 167 million people working. We have the longest job expansion in the history of the U.S.
Which started when?
2010.
Okay.
So even in the depths of the Great Recession, we had over 140 million people working. So a lot of the numbers you've heard in the media or on the internet were just not true.
Very simplistic.
You know, they're just making up stuff. The Great Recession lost 8.7 million people. We've created 17 million jobs plus since then. So,
we should be in a positive of about 10.
Most people are working. But there is a group that, you know, you could see it in the prime age labor force. I always like to take the prime age labor force group, ages 25 to 54, because of more people going to education. 16 to 24 needs to be kind of excluded from the data, and your first job is not going to be at age 55. So prime age labor force, there is about 2 to 3 million people that still aren't working. And if you look at it, obviously you can't force women who want to take care of their kids to work, but there are men out there, and they tend to be high school dropouts, they tend to be drug addicts that are not in rehab, criminals coming back from jail, active criminals. These people need help. The rest, I think, are fine. So I think,
what could you do for them?
Are they getting help?
And what could you do for them?
And what kind of help are
they
getting?
I would love a kind of a federal government guaranteed job program, because I don't think the public sector wants to hire these people. I don't think the private sector wants to hire these people either. If you can get some type of purpose for these, and we're a population of 325 million people. We're talking about 2 to 3 million people right now. Most people are working, so
easily absorbed.
Yeah, easily they could be absorbed to do jobs around the. I mean, right now we have 6.2 million job.
Like the old Conservation Corps of CCC.
Well, remember the Work Progress Administration.
Work Progress Administration.
Yeah,
all that, right.
To that nature, and it wouldn't be that big. It wouldn't be even that expensive.
Right.
Because most people are working. That's not the issue. We don't have a jobs program. We have a labor force growth program.
So can I ask you a couple of questions here? What do you do for...
Hold on. We have a labor force growth program.
Yes, and I think the missing discussion point always in this economic cycle is that prime age labor force growth peaked in 2007. It was forecasted from decades. It never gets any play because demographics is not a very favorable enemy to have.
Amen. I'm always saying that we're on the backside of productivity here. The baby boomers are getting older.
So now we're tying into things like immigration and work visas and things of that nature, right?
This is birth rates. This is
birth. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, this is something that has been forecast for a long time. The entire world, outside of certain areas, obviously Africa and India, they're very young. We're very young and we're very old in the cycle. Ages 17 to 29 are massive, and ages 49 to 65 were massive. So that household formation, which you would need for growth, is going to be light from 2008 to 2019. This is basically my big macroeconomic theme for housing. I've always said that this housing cycle simply won't have enough mortgage demand because the demographics are more for renting. Just like the baby boomers, when they were in their teens and 20s, they were renters until they got married.
So what happens to all that inventory that's basically out there that's not for rental? That's been put on the market larger than probably what we need. What happens to all that inventory?
Here's the thing with inventory. I think inventory gets blamed for the wrong reasons. I think if you look at the consistency of housing data for 20 years, home prices deviated from historical norms in 1996. Post 1996, we have never had 6 months of inventory in America outside of the housing bust years. So 2006 to 2011, that was forced selling. That was the Great Recession. You had exotic debts that forced people to liquidate their homes. After that, there's actually more monthly supply of inventory in this cycle for both new and existing homes than there were in the past. You just don't have the demand, and that's predicated with you don't have the demographics for homeownership.
But I guess that's what I'm asking, Logan, is, okay, so there's not a lack of inventory, but there's a lack of demand. And which reflects what you were talking about in terms of mortgages. So what happens to that inventory that's sitting there?
It's 10-year of housing is at all-time highs. It's 10 years right now. Everyone used to always say 5 to 7 years people used to move their house. No, it's the people are staying in their homes longer.
Sure.
Baby boomers are not downsizing.
Absolutely.
So you get a stuck period. People are just sitting in their homes. It's great for Home Depot and Lowe's, obviously, refurnishing.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't know if you noticed, but when we started the show, the other thing that I do is, you know, Your Home for a Lifetime is basically a certified aging in place service that I provide on the interior side, where we go into people's homes and modify them so they can stay in them longer. Mm-hmm. And that actually was very, very good during the down economy, because people didn't have to move. Yeah. Because their pre-programming is that you're older, the kids are gone, and you got to downscale, move to something else. You're healthy, you're active, you're familiar with your environment and neighborhood, and you didn't want to move because you're also going to take a ding on your house. So being able to get another 5 or 10 years usage out of it, sure, I'm going to stay in there. So to your point, people are staying in their homes longer.
And also the secondary factor is a lack of selling equity. And selling equity to me is defined as how much equity do you have after you sell your house, pay your transaction costs,
and you are left with.
And to me, the most minimum conservative model I could use is that you need 28% to 33% minimum equity to sell your house, pay the transaction costs, and have enough money for
How much of the market has that?
Not much. I mean,
interesting. Another point that doesn't really get covered.
Because what we've done in this society is that we have subsidized housing by creating. I mean, mortgage rates are low just because inflation is low, but we have low down payment loans. We have low FICO score loans. So you allow people with 3.5%, 5%, 10% down, and that's great for home ownership. That gets first-time home buyers.
But what
it does is that it creates a longer time period needed to move up, because there's a lot of people still living in condos who have two kids who are not moving up because it's expensive, because that higher-priced home
is out of reach.
Is getting more and more. And you do not have the exotic loans now that you did in 2003 to 2006 to facilitate that demand. The biggest mistake in the previous cycle I think housing people make is that they think 1996 to 2007 was a bubble. You had good demographics for housing during that period. 2003 to 2006 was the speculation demand. That's when, you know, 80-10-10 countrywide loans, Downey say, all these things started to become more popular because the real cost of housing was more expensive. But now, we always talk about nominal home prices in America or in Orange County or in Southern. That's not the best way to look at it. Real home prices are not back to where they were in 2006, and interest rates are lower. So it's still affordable. Real affordability is actually better now still. But that's predicated on one big macro theme. Every single housing cycle since 1981 has had 2% lower interest rates. For this to happen in the next cycle, you need 1.25 to 2.25 30-year fixes. If that doesn't happen for the first time in four decades, we have a de facto rate increase in a new housing cycle. So in years 2020 to 2024 is what I always say the demographic demand for housing is going to be better. And why? It's because, you know, I try to, like, not dumb this down, but try to talk English so people can understand that. Americans have to rent first.
Right.
They have to date.
Mm-hmm.
They have to mate.
Mm-hmm.
They have to get married. Okay?
You get in that order, Paul.
In that order. So you have a lot of young people who get married a lot older. You know, millennials are the biggest home buyers in America.
I got married for the first time at the age of 49.
Yeah. Probably not that late, but ages 31 to 35 are the bulk of the millennial home buyers.
That's
They're the biggest home buyers in America, which makes them the biggest home buyers in the world. Ages 21 to 27 are the biggest in America right now. They're still too young, so we just have to grind this out a few more years.
And I have to ask you the question I was trying to ask earlier. We have many people come and talk about it. We had an Orange County Housing Council or realtors and all sorts of other people come in. Why are the baby boomers deferring family formation and all that goes with it, housing and all the other purchases? They're putting it off and getting married later, as you were kind of alluding to. And what does that do to the whole housing
cycle? It moves everything up.
You know, we need to go to the break, but of course I knew my wife was going to be listening in, right? My wife's actually she's the head of admissions for...
Get it right now. Don't screw it up, Harry. Don't screw up the title.
She's the director of admissions for the Graduate College of Education at Cal State Long Beach.
All right.
So any of the certificates, you know, for teaching and what have you, higher education, basically goes through her department. And they get a lot of people that actually apply. But she was listening in, and she actually said to me, well, she didn't say anything about me getting married at the age of 49, so that's a good thing, right?
But she did let that one slide.
She let that one slide. But she did say that most people who have student loans debt and default one of the things that we also don't bring into the conversation, went to profit colleges or for-profit colleges,
yeah.
Right?
who are not
competitive for admission. No. So there are other nuanced layers to this conversation that tends to be, you know, just kind of blown over or covered over, and we make these general statements, but the devil is in the details.
I always tell people, don't worry about the college-educated dual-income class in America. This is the best household formation group the world has ever seen in terms of income, assets, 401ks, healthcare plans. This is the cream of the crop in the history of mankind in terms of middle-class families. The people you should worry about are those who never went to college, who don't have any skill sets. Okay, there are people who buy homes that just graduated from high school, but they have a skill set. They have a sales skills. There's something they have skill set. That group is struggling because they have to pay for the inflationary rates of cost of living, but their incomes against cost of living hasn't risen.
But yet that's not a very large group, correct?
No, that's a large group in the sense that this is a service sector industry.
Yeah.
So I see what you're saying. You have a lot of people that are
right.
in that income bracket. It's not the majority. I would say it's 30% of the U.S. is in that income bracket. So it's enough to make it. And the thing is that this group has gotten a lot older too. The baby boomers first hit 62 right in 2008.
Right.
So you have a lot of older Americans who don't have a lot of savings, who are probably feeling a lot insecure.
Why is everybody looking at me?
Yeah. So.
I do. You know what? Let's take a break, Paul, and I want to come back and let's talk about that sector and that group of people.
If you are like the majority of Americans, you want to continue living in a familiar environment throughout your maturing years. In fact, according to many surveys, 82% of homeowners overwhelmingly prefer to age in place, which means living in their current homes safely, independently, and comfortably, regardless of age or ability level. With over 30 years of combined experience in residential, commercial, hospitality, and destination resorts fields, Your Home for a Lifetime is a company dedicated to empowering you to maintain your quality of life and independence by helping you make your house your home for a lifetime. Do you want to reorganize or remodel your home? Do you want to add a full bathroom and possibly a bedroom on the main floor? Are you looking to make your kitchen more functional? Is an aging parent moving in, or your child is moving out, or even moving back in? Call Your Home for a Lifetime at 949-492-1872 or check them out on the web at yourhomeforalifetime.com and find out how they can help you make your house your home for a lifetime.
Okay, we're back. So here's the thing, okay? In this day and age, when we are so accustomed to getting everything in little blurbs,
yes.
Okay, when we went to the break, Logan was saying, you know, I said, how do you think? What do you think? How do you think the show is going? And he goes, oh, that's great. You know, I usually get like 10 minutes to do a Bloomberg thing. Well, you know what? I am proud that we can give you more time than Bloomberg.
That's right. Right.
But no, what the heck are you going to cover in 10 minutes, right? I mean, this stuff is not. You really need to delve into it. You really need to look at all these nuances. I know it's boring. It's details. Ugh, you know, right? But here's the other thing, right? The gentleman that's sitting in front of me here, okay, isn't, you know, it's a family business, right? You guys, tell a little bit about your background.
AMC Lending Group, is a family-owned mortgage business we've had since 1987. Our family in general has been in banking since the late 1950s. This is what we do. I got into the stock market in 1996, so I just, my personality is to learn as much as I possibly can, and that got me into economics. In 2010, some financial websites saw what I was discussing on Facebook. They said, would you like to write about political economics? I said, no, let me write about real estate economics.
Right.
And the motivation for me really was that I wasn't too impressed by the housing economists in the last cycle. And I thought that a lack of understanding of how residential debt structures works with economics, that they kind of failed the country. And I thought this cycle, it's going to be one of these cycles where demand is not going to be hit because of demographics, and they're going to blame tight lending, and they're going to blame inventory, and then the following week they're going to say we have record-breaking demand, and they're going to almost, to me, sound bipolar. And I thought, I as a almost like a duty, to talk about housing economics from a banking perspective of somebody who tracks leading economic indicators, unemployment claims, currencies, commodities, just to give that perspective. And
you know who we should match him up with? We had on a year ago on another show here, Doug Duncan, I think that's his name.
Yeah, Duncan's a friend.
Chief economist for the Fannie Mae.
I go to a conference in Texas. Usually a lot of the economists are there. Last year we had a good group of there. We were talking about
housing. So let's help people that are listening, Logan. What do you use as a benchmark? What do you use as a litmus test to who is doing this the right way versus just interested in sound bites that are going to be bipolar in 24 hours and tell you the opposite side of the...
I honestly think that you have to look at the source and see the language. Economists, we all work from the same data. We all have the same data.
Which is what we were talking about earlier.
There's nothing different. It's the way we perceive data. And if people are using terminology that is either too extremely bearish or too extremely bullish, if they cannot prove that with data, then I think they're either emotionally invested or they're financially invested. I could give you two great examples. The economist for Redfin a few months ago said we have record-breaking demand in housing. Immediately I said to her, mortgage demand is back to 1998 levels. Without cash buyers in America, you have less than 5 million home sales. New home sales adjusting to population using a six-month moving average is today below 5 of the last 6 recessions. There is no record-breaking demand. Yesterday, Trulia came out with their economists. They said demand is insatiable. Every time I hear this, I remind myself, this is why I do it. Because there has to be a middle ground where you don't, and I understand sensationalizing in economic theory brings clicks in, but there is a loyalty to numbers and facts and data, and you cannot bound yourself by either financial investment or emotional investment.
Well, and we were talking about it before, right? It's like, you know, that people are like fear or greed, right? Fear or greed. So the sense, I mean, it's if I come out and I say, oh, it's the demand is insatiable, right? The first thing that if I'm thinking of, you know, I'm living in an apartment and I'm thinking maybe I can extend myself out of my comfort zone. Yeah. My grandfather used to say, extend your legs to the length of your blanket, right?
Yeah.
No, I'm going to extend my legs a little further than my blanket, right? I'm going to take that risk. And I hear somebody say, it's insatiable, you know, and everybody I'm talking to is telling me, oh, my God, you know, the market is just on fire. I'm thinking it's only just going to keep going this way. If I'm going to do this, I better get it in. There's a fear that I'm going to miss out. So sometimes these things are motivated.
It's called the National Association of Realtors.
Yeah. Oh, send your angry replies.
Where can people send your angry replies?
I study people, sentence structure, speech patterns, body language, and I've documented this work. There's extreme bulls. The worst are these extreme bears, these what I call anti-central bank, pro-gold. Everything is dying. Every single day they have the market's going to crash.
So how do you feel about Bitcoin?
Bitcoin to me is an interesting technology. It's not a currency until you can pay your taxes with it. But the funny thing with Bitcoin is that I'm not a fan of the gold bugs because they always say the world's coming to an end.
Yeah.
But because Bitcoin is more favorable for younger people, gold has lost its luster. So the marketing of gold is really to old baby boomers right now. You know, they always have a commercial of some war about to happen or some horrible event. Adjusting to inflation, gold returns are down 30% since 2011. It's the gold bugs or the anti-central bank people, the people who keep on talking about the world every single year we're going to crash. These are the worst macro people I've ever seen in my life. Whatever I think of housing people, these people basically lie every single day just for the sake of being popular. There's other people, Harry Dent, Peter Schiff, Mark Faber. There's all these people, every single... So I've collected them. I've collected their statements and stuff over the years. We have the longest job expansion in history. It's 82 months. The previous record was 48 back in the late 80s. We get to mid-2019, we're going to have the longest economic expansion on record. That means for the first time ever in U.S. history, we've had the longest economic expansion with the longest job expansion in the same cycle, and we've had a graveyard of recession end-of-the-world callers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem with the Internet in the sense that they do it for marketing purposes.
Or political aspirations.
Political aspirations.
Yeah.
But their theories are just really, really bad. And you see a lot of bad information. You know, the labor participation rate was never explained correctly. There's not 100 million people out of work. We've always had a growing population of people not working.
Donald Trump says, I think it's even higher than the numbers.
Yeah, so there's all these things that are just bad information. So to me, that's personal in the sense that they go against what facts and data should be.
Well,
they're storytellers.
I'll tell you, I commend you because it may sound very sort of elitist or egotistical that somebody's saying, well, you know, it's a personal thing. I commend you because I think you really have to take these things personally, when especially in sort of the day and age of the internet, the irresponsibility of putting out information in that manner.
Yeah.
Okay, whether it is for I just want to be loved and I want to be popular, God, you know, oh, look, I got so many
or
likes
prove
on Facebook
a point,
or whatever,
or
right?
Prove a point,
or,
I've already
or,
got a...
Or more, yeah. Or more sinister and reasons, right? That really has real effects. That really has people, you know, like people make decisions in their lives based on that information. And for you to be putting out information and not take it personally to be accurate, to be... non-biased, to not try to sway somebody one way or the other and give them the best opportunity to come to their own conclusions based on facts. That is a rare thing, my friend. And
you can't be political. You know, that's the thing, is that I think political economic theory is it's inherently in our nature. That's who we are. We're human beings. And like our football teams each Sunday, we want to be part of a group, and it's always fighting against another group. And the president, to me, is the least most important thing in terms of macroeconomics, in terms of what's going on in a cycle.
Right.
Demographics, profit margins, inflation, there's all these other variables. Just because of the structural power of what a president has, it's very difficult for them to really move. And the variables are Congress, who elects Congress. There's all these things. So a sitting president, we always use every economic cycle based on a president. And that's human nature. And
it's a story as old as time, right?
Yeah,
Whoever's sitting in the chair gets all the credit and all the blame.
So we only have about 10 minutes left. I'm still struggling. What is it that you are seeing coming? Make your prediction. Plop yours down based on your cold analysis.
Before you do that, though, I don't want to miss this out. So share with people how they can find you.
Yes.
Share some of the websites that you have. You touched on one of them earlier.
The best way is just my name, Logan Motashami, LoganMotashami. My Facebook page is open to everyone, and we basically cut out people who curse, who say evil and bad things. It's basically charts all day. We do some historical photos and historical artwork at night, so it doesn't get too boring. But you know, the blog is always there with reference paperwork.
And what's your day job? What do you do by day here?
Mortgages.
Yes. So with your family business.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. And just to be in full disclosure, right, another interesting thing about this person's wide personality is he didn't go to school for this.
No, my full intention was to be a high school basketball coach at Irvine High and teach history.
So how did you end up into this? Because it's a family business?
You know what? In 1996, I got in the stock market, and I basically made more money in the first 3 months trading than I would be a teacher for a full year.
Wow.
And I thought, you know what? It's just... that's the profit margin, you know. So especially if you want to live in Irvine,
they pulled me in. They pulled me back into the family business.
I loved coaching. It was great. It was. I got the job at 18.
Right.
So it was a great job to have at that age for 6 years.
Yeah, but you know what? I'll tell you something. It's interesting. We always talk about this on the show. This is everybody's personal journey really reflects on how they lead their lives. Mm-hmm. In your particular case, I would say that the level of sincerity and integrity of which you do this, you share the information that you do, okay, in a certain way reflects the fact that you have a need and a desire to teach and direct people and guide them, which speaks to that maybe basketball coaching job that you were talking about before, right? Okay. And then history, a student of history, how could you not look at stuff in not more than a snippet, right,
yeah.
in a snapshot of time?
So look ahead. We got 5 minutes. Give us a summary of your worldview going forward. What we're getting wrong and what you're seeing we're headed.
I mean, I feel a lot better just listening to Logan so far because this very hectic way that it's being presented, you know, the doomsday kind of scenarios, I'm not hearing that.
So, first of all, the economic cycle looks fine. Leading economic indicators are positive. I always try to help people on what to look for a recession because there's everyone talks about a recession every year. It's never happening. Unemployment claims have to rise. It's unemployment claims are still low. We're going to get a brief hit on unemployment claims because of Harvey, but unemployment claims are low. Leading economic indicators are still positive. As long as those two things work together, they have predicted every single recession since 1960. And typically what happens is people think an economic cycle dies of old age. That's not true. Usually the Fed fights inflation. Unit labor costs get to be too strong for certain sectors of the economy. And the main thing is there has to be an overinvestment thesis in the general economy where the supply and demand balance finally turns. We have none of that in 2017.
No, you don't see a recession because everybody's saying this is the longest expansion. It's got to run out of steam.
Every year somebody says this is the longest economic expansion. It has to happen without looking at what actually creates a recession. And there's still nothing here. Now, usually you shouldn't look forecast 90 days out.
Right.
Because, I think what I'm known for is my prediction articles. I would take that, all my prediction articles against any economist or housing analyst. I would say I've probably done better. But really you can't look more than 90 days out. The set of variables for every prediction article has to set in place. But I still think we have legs. I still think we will break that record. We will be the first time ever that we'll have the longest economic expansion and longest.
And how does that translate into housing here? Prices are still going to go up.
How does that reflect locally?
Because you said demand is low. Demand is low.
Here's the thing about housing. I think the better years for housing is still a few years away, and I think this is the most solid, safest housing market we've ever seen.
Really?
I real home prices are not back to 2006 levels. Places like San Francisco, yes, but. Generally, demand is low. If you look at it, purchase application data is back to 1998 levels, and it should be there because we have so many young and old people. In a few years, we're going to have a household formation with the biggest group of our population, ages 21 to 27.
So you think this millennial generation that's been deferring family formation will finally start to form families, and then they'll want to buy houses and move up?
If you look at the data now, ages 31 to 35, the millennials are the biggest home buyers in the world today, but that's ages 31 to 35. So the biggest age group in America is still, half of them are
still
in college.
They're still not there.
They're in college still, half of them. So you have to be patient. I think my critique of the housing economists and analysts is that they keep on putting these unrealistic expectations for unit sale demands, and then when they don't hit it, they go, "Well, it's inventory."
Yeah, but that's sort of how everything is done, right?
Yeah.
Your sales projections are on a quarterly basis. You got to meet certain goals.
Yeah.
So if you basically tell somebody it's long-term planning, and be patient.
A great example. I wasn't looking for any growth in existing home sales this year, and we're slightly above that level. Cash buyers are a little bit stronger than this year than I thought, and I think it's fine. I think this has been a solid year for housing, but you have everybody saying, "Oh, home sales aren't where they used to be." So to me personally, in a few years, you get better demographics. So it's going to be a battle between really good demographics for housing and affordability. And where are interest rates going to be in the next decade? Because if they're not at 1.25% to 2.25%, for the first time in four decades plus, we've had an interest rate hike, in a sense, for housing.
Well, and those people that you're talking about, that demographic you're talking about, that would be entry-level houses, right?
I mean,
that's not destination locations, not higher property.
They eventually move to the suburbs.
Right.
You know, everyone loves the city, but when you want to raise a family, you move to the suburbs.
How do you factor in that baby boomer population that's staying in their homes longer, that isn't moving, that's healthier?
Me, right.
I read a statistic I shared with Paul earlier this year where a certain percentage of new home sales with baby boomers was not to smaller units. They were to larger units because they wanted their grandkids to have another second home. So how do you balance that out?
Well, majority of new home sales are much bigger homes anyway from the cycle, but the unit sales are still low. I mean, when I tell people that sales levels adjusting to populations are still at recessionary levels today, even with this long expansion, even with over 167 million people working, even with interest rates below 5%, so we don't have an overinvestment or over-demand cycle in housing. It's going to be slow and steady until we get better demographics, and then these first-time owners will have more equity to move up. They will relieve that first-time home buying home to younger people, which has been happening because the millennials are still the biggest home buyers in America.
But aren't you saying we're not at record or near record home prices? I mean, I just look at the average house price is $600,000 here.
On the nominal basis, we are, but you know, we always talk about real incomes, you know, because we adjust to inflation. We don't do that for housing or home prices for some reason. So real home prices are not at 2006 levels. They're still 13 to 16% below.
And I'm confused by that. So explain that.
So adjusting to inflation. Inflation never went negative in the cycle. So real incomes and real inflation have been growing. So if you adjust it to real home prices, only on the nominal level, because that's what the housing bubble was so epic in prices because real home prices were so
exaggerated.
So much exaggerated. It was unbelievable. We're nowhere near there because inflation has always been growing, but home prices are just basically nominal back. So it's not as expensive as some people think.
So when you hear 600,000, you're not taking into effect.
Well, you're taking the number on its own. I would be
suspect of anybody who says nominal home prices are back to highs without saying adjusting to inflation.
Well, and also the back to number was exaggerated and inflated.
Yeah. So
we have room to grow. If I have a $600,000 average house today here,
you have legs. And my biggest concern is that when the demographics get better for housing, it just pushes prices even up more. Because if you look at real home prices across the world, Canada, Sweden, Australia, New Zealand, these things are taking off like crazy. Here, we're cheap. You know, we're actually
in comparison. It's true.
In comparison. Now, Canada, of course, is, you know, those two cities in Canada mess up the entire country because Toronto and Vancouver. So take that index with somewhat of a grain of salt. But real home prices show that you have legs, because if you actually look at real home prices on a year-over-year basis, it's basically been flat for 4 years.
So we're going to have million-dollar average homes in 10 years, 20 years? I mean, that's just that sounds frightening, except that inflation and
I think certain markets already have that, Paul.
Where I live in Irvine, the median single-family home is $1.1 million, right now. So here's the thing. This is why the interest rate story is going to be very important. Because if we do get 1.25 to 2.25 30-year fixes, that means the downtrend in interest rates and inflation on a year-over-year basis for 4 decades has stayed the same, which gives you pricing power to service debt, because it's about debt servicing.
Right.
The problem is now that home prices are so big that the down payment levels, you know, you need more and more money, even for a lower down payment level, which forces 10-year of housing goes back to the selling equity.
Yep, you got to hold it longer and save longer.
The entire housing ecosystem changed after 1996, and you could see it in the data that when home prices deviated from historical norms, the 10-year of housing started to get longer. Now, we won't have the
10-year meaning people stay in their house longer.
People stay in their houses longer. Now, the housing bust also created 8 million-plus delinquent homeowners.
Right.
You won't have that in the next housing cycle.
Have we flushed that out of the system?
We're almost done. We're less than a million, really, left. So the irony is, back then in 2010, I said it'll take us to 2019 to flush everything out.
Let me ask you two other questions. We've had the Orange County Business Council in here, and they do this horrible lack of housing projection where they say, based on just, you know, average growth, people having kids and the job formations here and people coming to work here and live here and just, at Rod's point, having children and they want to buy homes, that we're a massive number of homes short here in Orange County.
Well, here's, you know, in 2014, I spoke at the BNY Mellon Stock Conference in Dana Point, and I told them that 82% of the working population in California are priced out of housing.
82%?
If you take away cash buyers and those who make 2.5 to 3 times median income. Part of the problem with California is that the coastal cities have college-educated dual-income households that make money.
Right.
You know, I just look at my clientele base. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a 200-300K households here. These are the people buying the homes. If you want growth, those people, there has to be more of them coming in. They have to have those kind of jobs. But it's really a dual income.
But if you have an 80+% of the community of the state of California that is basically priced out, okay, that you would think then the issue of affordable housing is huge.
Yeah,
and it's only going to continue to be a problem.
And the local politicians don't want it, and they force people to move east.
So my point
which
is
actually very not friendly.
No, and it puts
environmentally not friendly.
We have a net loss of millennials already in this county here, I'm told.
Since 2013, ages 30 to 39, you have people leaving the state, but you still have business creation in California. You know, I think the recent numbers were even good. So housing is just very expensive because the people who own homes make money.
So will we end up in Orange County here being like San Francisco or Manhattan, where the majority of people are never going to own a home? They're just going to live here and in this environment, have these high-paying jobs. They're just going to accept living in rental,
high-density
apartments,
multi-story.
Yeah, they're just that's not going to be part of the dream. Most people who live in Manhattan, you're never going to own.
Well, that changes the whole visual branding of the community.
I think you need 154,000 median income to buy a house in Orange County. So in a sense, Orange County has always been one of the more overinflated comparative fundamentals, just because so much of the population doesn't make that. But again, dual household incomes, college-educated people make those.
But they're throwing up apartments left and right. We see it everywhere around here. Everywhere I go, they're tearing down office buildings, throwing up apartments. So the assumption is that
there's a glut of commercial property.
The apartment boom, in terms of rate of growth, ended in 2015. These ones that are coming up are part of the last wave
building cycle.
But since 2015, the rate of growth has actually decelerated and has gone negative in terms of apartment.
And the reason is
that the rent inflation is falling, and it's fallen for 4 months now. And because the supply has finally caught up to the demand,
yeah.
And you get the switch over now. From
for that demographic that you were talking about.
Start to buy homes. So people always talk about rent inflation. Rent inflation has never hit the last two previous cycle peaks in this cycle. For all the talk we've talked about rent inflation, if you look at the data, the last two cycles were much stronger. So the supply has caught up.
Well, and that group of people, that demographic you were talking about, that are now moving, if you can hold onto your house and wait it out, then this is a larger demand group that's coming in, mm-hmm. to buy that first home. They're moving out of that rental situation. There is not a group as big that is coming behind them that would then replace the rental.
Gen X got absolutely obliterated in the housing bust. Millennials are buying, but Gen X, the boomerang buyers never came back, and the boomers are staying. At some point, the boomers do either downsize or die, or they pass their houses off to their
okay. So let me ask you this, but relevant to the boomers, okay?
I like that motto for us boomers. We're either going to downsize or die. Downsize
you know
or
what,
die.
You know
I'm going to paint that on the side of my car here.
On a good point, when everybody tells you robots are going to take over all the jobs, yeah. It is the biggest fallacy of logic ever, just because the entire world is going to have a mass population of people dying off.
Right.
In the next 30 years, you need replacement workers. This entire century around the world is all about who has replacement workers, and the only country that's developed that has a prime age labor force growth is America.
Yep.
China doesn't have it, Japan doesn't
right.
have it, Europe doesn't have it. It is going to be a race for replacement workers all over the world because we have a mass group.
Die off. The dinosaurs are going to die off here.
So that's going to make it really difficult to have things like immigration bins.
It's going to be impossible.
Right.
I don't.
Yeah.
You know,
the globalization.
You look at Germany. What they did. Why did Germany take so many refugees?
Yeah. Because they needed people.
The median age in Germany is like 65.
Yeah.
They need workers.
It's going to be a race.
And anybody who travels and experiences for themselves those countries and other societies understands that because they've seen it. You walk down the street. Absolutely. Absolutely correct evaluation. The thing with Europe and certain places like Germany is that you have an older population, you don't have that influx, and so you can say whatever you want to say about immigration, right? There is a necessity because if without it, you can't sustain the economy.
I'm a demographics guy.
And isn't that part of the problem with what they're trying to propose now of curtailing or cutbacking or literally kicking people out, that this without immigration, we're going to become Japan and Germany? We're going to have an aging population with no replacement buyers and workers?
We have a massive young population, so we're not going to be like Japan. But, you know, I'm comfortable in saying this. I think President Obama will deport more Hispanics than President Trump, just because we had a lot of illegal immigrants leave the country in 2008. So this is why
you mean President Trump will deport?
No, President Obama, because he was there for 8 years. But
they called him the deporter in chief for a while. He was deporting so many people.
You had more supply back then. The supply is actually lower. This is
almost negative. Right?
This is one of the reasons why you have job openings for construction workers.
Right.
You know, hours worked are high,
right.
Wages are high,
right.
Wage growth is high, but they can't find the workers. So what happened to all these supposedly people sitting at home for 8 years not working?
Right.
They're not there.
Right.
They left.
It was always a myth. It was always a myth that people were sitting at home paying their mortgage.
But we're going to build a massive wall to keep them out. We're going to do all these other things to round them up and kick them out.
If Trump's own data work shows that it's not even really needed.
Right, but see, that's just a construction project, really. Yeah. It's not based on need. It's based on building. So let me ask you one last question, because we don't talk about it enough, I think, but this is appropriate discussion, I think, for this show, is what about reverse mortgages?
Good idea, bad idea.
Because it's a big, huge appeal, and I've got, Tom Selleck out there and Robert Wagner before him, and, selling to the baby boomers.
Because the baby boomers like me have saved, I'm told, a record low amount of money, and we're going to live longer than anybody with less in the bank.
Hold on a second, Logan. Okay, so that's your take as
What I hear all the time. Oh, yeah. That's what I hear all the time.
As a mortgage person, I've never offered it, and I never will.
And reason?
Just because I don't feel comfortable giving that product just as much as
I know I'm pushing you, but why don't you?
I think there's too many variables in that loan that needs the attention of a CPA and family members to be part of the process, and I don't want to deal with it. Just like the
variables such as? Just a couple.
Just the long-term plan of that reverse mortgage impacts that family. So,
more than the person who's actually getting into it.
Yeah, so
generationally.
I think that's, in this day and age, I understand the necessity of it for certain people.
Based on what Paul was just saying.
Yeah, just because there are a lot of people with equity, and obviously Social Security is just a supplement income. It's not designed for retirement, so you could tap into that. Personally, myself, it's the same way I thought about subprime loans. I just don't feel comfortable with it, so I don't offer it. It's regulated, so there are concerns about it from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. But like anything, do your homework, investigate, get a CPA, but get your family members so everybody has an idea of what's going to happen. But
so is it a trend that's growing in terms of people getting into it?
It should grow just based on the demographics. Again, boomers hit 62 in 2008. The mass population of older Americans are actually ages 51 and 56. So you're starting to get that influx.
And they're going to live longer than any generation with less money in the bank.
So here's the thing, a vehicle that is somewhat Logan is apprehensive about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's growing in terms of people getting into it.
Right.
And he made a comparison with subprime. Are we looking at a potential issue with reverse mortgages?
It's different in the sense the old debt structure subprime loans were designed to fail over time. This isn't. This is more of a long-term financial structure that the family might not want later on. But it provides some short-term benefits where the subprime allowed you to get into the house. But it was almost, in a sense, it was designed as a
setting you up. Basically.
It was designed as a Band-Aid loan, so you eventually would, in theory, have to refinance out of it because you couldn't.
You couldn't sustain it.
So you danced around. I'll see if I can push what Rad was trying to say. So what's bad about it for the family, other than that mom and dad are going to suck up all the equity in the house?
That's
and
the thing is that you have to understand the long term.
They're going to leave nothing behind.
Well, for the kids, of course, the kids probably might not like that, but you have to look at the long-term planning of how much money you're going to get, how much you're going to come in, because you might even outlive your reverse mortgage. So
See, I never heard that.
No, that's where I was going with this.
Yeah, I never heard that. How does that explain to me? How does that work?
Hold on. Aren't you guys baby boomers that are going to live forever? Aren't you basically
well,
that,
that's
right?
That's true.
Yeah, so that's my
but
point.
I don't understand
you're healthier. You may not be experiencing those medical needs to where you're basically drawing on the house for stuff like that, perhaps, till later or longer, right?
Right.
But if you get into this, again, when you get into it, and I agree with him, and that's why I was trying to bring it up, because it sounds great on paper, but like everything else, you need to be careful. And in this particular thing,
it does provide work for aging actor men.
Yeah, right. So. All right, but you I don't understand it, and I'm the problem here.
Because
I've thought about this. What do I do if I'm 90 and I've run out of my savings and everything's cost more? I got one last thing. I got the house, and if I don't tap into that, I don't know what I do. I can't sell it and move somewhere. So how does it work? Let's say I'm 80 and I start to take money out of the thing and I live to be 100. You're saying that I've drawn all the equity to the house, but they don't force me out of the house. I'm still in the house, but I'm still out of money. Is that what you're saying?
You really need to have a long-term plan if you're going to do a reverse mortgage and talk about it with your family. You should be talking with your family members anyway when you're that age, you know, because most likely your kids are going to.
Right.
In fact, that's my big macro theme going out for 40 years. How much disposable income do children are going to have to pay to take care of their parents?
Yeah, we talk about that in the show all the time.
I can't model that out. There's not enough information out there, but I know that we're going to have a huge amount of people that didn't save for retirement, and they're going to.
You want to talk about a potential crisis?
Huge.
That's it right there.
Yeah.
Huge.
I mean, that's the number one thing for me looking out, because you have a big wave of young and old, and disposable income isn't big anyway, so
right. It
has to go to taking care of.
Well,
them.
Look, by the way, happy birthday.
Oh, thank you.
Okay.
So,
tomorrow, right, isn't it?
Less than 12 hours, yeah.
Less than 12 hours.
And what age range are you in?
I'll be 42 tomorrow.
Right.
Oh, you wannabes here. You're not real baby boomers. You're just wannabes.
Okay, so at 42, I'm 52. Okay,
and I'm going to be 62 in January. I'll be 62 in January.
He's 62. He keeps...
In January.
I think it's a way for him to keep remembering that his memory works by getting that, because he does it all the time.
In January.
But okay, so at 42, I mean, how old are your parents?
65.
Right. My parents are like older, in the late 70s, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So absolutely, you and I share exactly the same thing, because you're looking at it, you, the way you're wired, you're looking at things long term, right? But I'm looking at it, it's a reality of life for me. I'm looking at that and I'm seeing my parents age. I'm seeing that the fact that, you know, fortunately enough, we may be able to sustain them, because everything's coming out of savings. Everything's going to come out from asset management. It's not going to come out from any kind of insurance coverage, mm-hmm. right? The quality of life that they expect, and it's going to be long. It's not going to be, oh, darn, they just went through, you know, like my grandfather who just had, you know, suffered from Alzheimer's for 5 years, and then he basically, fortunately, you know, stopped having that suffering. But this is a crisis in the making, and we have talked about it being a crisis in the making for the last, I've been a certified aging place since 2008. For almost 10 years we've been talking about this, right? And I have seen nothing other than potentially further risk. Mm-hmm. Through vehicles like reverse mortgage. And the conversations, I mean, most people don't talk. Have you talked to your daughter, Paul, about you know, I don't know, will, you know, what your directives would be in
Never.
Case you basically...
I don't want to talk about it, and she doesn't want to listen.
So here's another situation that is, that includes the two things you don't want to talk about, getting older and money from the family, right? And how did that... But I agree with Logan. I think anybody who's going to look at doing that, understandably, because you're trying to leverage the equity in your house, and you're worried about the fact that you didn't save enough to basically age, you really should be looking at it long term and involving other people in the conversation.
Yeah, because it's going to happen. I think it's just we're still not at that age, just because if you look at the growing labor force growth in working, it's all ages 55 and up.
Right.
Since the start of the century, just because we never had this many older people,
right.
But now they're working longer. So because they're working longer, right. They still have some kind of sustainable income to keep them up.
Right. Some
but
the encore
some
careers
point,
and. They're going to not.
The laws of physics and human nature just come out.
Right. My aunt, we talk about all the time on the show, is 93. Never got married. No kids. No nothing. Fortunately, she was a secretary, so she has a little tiny pension and a little Social Security. Amounts to $2,500 a month. And she's homebound. She shouldn't be. She should be in assisted living or some sort of... Not independent living, this is the point, assisted living, she can't afford it. Starts $4,000 or $5,000
a month. Because Logan was saying, number one, which has always been the case, number one cost outlay is shelter, mm-hmm. right? In the case of your aunt, that shelter now is in the form of assisted living.
Right.
Okay? Assisted living shelter is friggin' more than a mortgage payment.
That's why multi-general housing is going to be very popular in the next 30 years.
So we're all going to end up taking these people back in. But even if you take them in, then somebody, you said the only way I can afford the home is a dual income. Somebody has to stay home and take care of them. You give up half of that dual income for somebody to sit home and take care of that 93-year-old person.
Well, there's your job market, right? I mean, it's
there's your job guarantee program the federal government could do.
Exactly.
They could get people to train them to take care of older.
And believe it or not, a few years ago, there were some experimental programs. I was involved with them, with one of them out of a sort of an AmeriCorps program from Cal State Fullerton. And it was basically aimed at seniors, and it was aimed at trying to have.
So I'm going to take drug addicts and felons who can't get employed anywhere else, and I'm going to put them in charge of my grandma here at home.
Somehow, and it wasn't a full-time thing because it was a pilot program, but somehow having the person who's a family member, who's actually putting their life kind of on hold to take care of that senior, basically be compensated in some format to justify that job, because it's a person who cares, who's
part of. And that's actually part of the data line we see. We see people in the data saying, I'm not working a job because I'm taking care of an elderly person. That's part of, you know, at first wave was taking care of your children.
Which is a huge job.
But now it's now it's a turnover, and
we've talked about the, you know, the sort of the profile of that caregiver in many cases. So surviving spouse or to a surviving parent is a woman in her late 40s to 50s that happens to have kids maybe going to college or finishing school, that is taking care of a household, that's holding a job, and basically has a family and is taking care of it. That is prime. And can you imagine the stress level and the cost outlays and the cost to the family?
We had a woman on just the other day.
All under shelter.
We had a woman on the other day, a successful business coach and author, and she moved. Her mother got severe dementia. Could not afford, had owned a house, but couldn't afford to move anywhere else into $6,000-$8,000 a month facility. So she ended up shuttling back and forth, ruined her marriage. So she's now divorced, and she's full time taking care of mom. Had to move back into mom's house because that was paid for.
And that cost, that loss of marriage, whatever,
and
that,
income.
But that I think goes back to what Logan was talking about. That's why you need to involve people. That's why you have to proactively, you know, in advance, plan this thing long term,
right.
Because if nobody tells you that there's going to be stress out of responsibility or out of a sense of duty, you take care of that person,
right?
But nobody tells you or prepares you to the other side of it. I mean, I've seen it with people I know that their relationships with their kids, their relationship with their spouse, basically start to suffer as they take on this thing,
and
somebody has to stop them and say, look, before it gets to the point where it's stressful and resentful, you have to prepare for that and talk it through, because you're all in this together. And if you don't, there will be a cost.
So this woman said she's taken a tremendous hit in her income. She lost her marriage, and now has to live with her mother again, which is stressful in itself, and watch her
deteriorate.
And they economically, it's the only way they can make this work, because the house was paid off. They could sell the house, and mom could live in assisted living for a couple of years. But
yeah,
mom's
like
not projected
at
to
die. At the low end of $2,000 or $3,000 to a full boat of $7,000 to $10,000 a month.
Yeah,
Where's that income in the house? I mean, $1 million home. How much leverage are you going to get out of that?
Right.
Yeah, I'm bringing this up not because we want to talk about sort of the senior component, but I'm bringing it up because, again, the primary element that makes this possible is shelter, is housing,
right?
And we keep talking about these things in sort of a profit and loss only, but there's actual human cost that's also involved.
Right. And at one point, we were so used to saying that the shelter is also sheltering our income. It's your last savings. It's your best savings. When is it? Generations ago, people didn't think they were going to make money. They were bought a house to shelter, and maybe they'd get their money back out of it, or maybe they'd pass it on to their kids and became generational housing. Now we view it as our better than the stock market. It's our only source
of
savings.
We started the show and we said, you know, that a lot of this stuff is driven emotionally, right? And we're getting a little emotional about discussing it right now, which is fine. What I'm saying is, in order to manage and navigate through those emotional waters, sometimes getting down to the basic data versus the scare tactics is something that is a benefit. If you start there, then you're more likely to be able to navigate through those things, to plan for them, to be proactive versus reactive, because you're now subject to what's happening.
So as we end the show, give us those websites to get that rational, cold, unemotional data that you're supplying.
I wouldn't call it cold. Ignore him. He's a baby boomer. What is he?
No, but where would you get this this rational, unemotional...
Factual.
Factual.
Just type in Logan Motoshami on Facebook, and basically I data source almost all the information you can possibly imagine.
And spell your last name again.
Motashami.
Okay.
And we make it a friendly environment to talk about MacroEd, because we don't allow
I'll tell people this, okay? Like when you're approaching a website like Logan's, okay, or a person with this, I know it sounds overwhelming. It sounds like it's so much, and you don't want to deal with it, right? Better to be empowered by having dipped your toe at least in that water,
and
it gets a little bit more comfortable the more you do it, rather than be surprised and blindsided. Because
and this is why we do Facebook Live now. We do Facebook Lives on economics to talk about it, to try to explain it. Because I understand charts aren't for everyone. You know, it's not gonna connect to everyone. But if you talk about economics and talk about it in a fashion, a form of just facts.
Well, maybe we can get you to come back and talk to our audience more, because I think it is a subject, speaking of personal experience, that it's something most of my friends, aging baby boomers, don't want to think about. We've got our head buried in the sand. We don't. It's just so frightening, so unimaginable what the future looks like. For the first time in my life, I'm afraid, and most of my friends are. When I was 20, nothing made me afraid. When I was 30, there's nothing afraid. 50, I can always work my way out of stuff. 60 to 70 sounds scary. I don't know what my health is going to look like. I don't know what my finances are going to look like. I don't know how many years I'm going to live. I don't know what the cost is going to be to live those
years. But burying your head in the sand is a guaranteed certain outcome. I know it's kind of, it sounds like you know, a cliche, but you know, knowledge is power. And I understand it's scary. I understand that those charts are, you know, daunting.
Intimidating.
I'm going to admit that I don't know. It's okay. The first step of actually getting there is to say, I don't know. Give me some clarity.
So it's a 12-step economic program. So it starts with
the question is not asking one.
That is the worst question, is not to ask one. Right?
In the 12-step program, the first thing is to admit you have a problem?
Well, right. And I think when it comes to financial, there's a lot of people that are in the dark. And I think it's okay to ask the question. There is no stupid question. The gentleman sitting in front of me here is very personable, very approachable. We've just spent over an hour basically talking about this stuff. And I think I encourage you all to go to his website, to also be critical in who you are listening to. Okay, you deserve a very fact-based reality thing that doesn't scare you.
I watch Fox News,
facts. Doesn't sell you, you know, the world seeing through rose-colored glasses. Get empowered. Listen to people like Logan. Reach out to us. Let us know what you thought of the show. We will have you back, because I think this is just something that's going to constantly change, mm-hmm. right? As we have this demographic move in, you know, we will revisit this topic. I appreciate it. Thank you for letting me
geek. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Geek out with you for an hour and a half. And Paul, as always, good questions. Always a good representative of the baby boomer generation over there.
The fearful future.
And I hope everybody, you know, let us know, and you can let us know at the Rad Life on Facebook, RAADLIFE, or you can reach me on at Rod, RAAD, period, Gantus, GHANTOUS, at gmail.com, or you can call me on my cell phone, 949-212-8299. I'll connect you with Logan. Thank you, thank you, thank you for being here today.
Thank you, my pleasure.
All right.
You have been listening to the Rad Life Radio Show with your host and age explorer, Rad Gontos, brought to you on the one and only OCTalkRadio.net. Join us again next week as we continue our journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older.